Praise be Jesus Christ, and welcome back to episode 25 of Carmelcast. I'm Brother Pier Giorgio of Christ the King. I'm joined by Brother John Mary of Jesus Crucified and Father Michael Joseph of St. Therese. And Carmelcast is a production of the Institute of Carmelite Studies Publications. For more information, we ask you to visit our website at www.icspublications.org. In our last episode, we were talking about the surmounting tensions between Fray John of the Cross and the Discalced Reform and the Calced Friars from which he came from. Before we get into that action, we want to give Father Michael Joseph the opportunity to share the saying of light and love that he chose from our Holy Father, St. John of the Cross.
Yes.
And why he chose it.
Yes, for sure. This is good. I chose number 64. See that you are not suddenly saddened by the adversities of this world, for you do not know the good they bring, being ordained in the judgments of God for the everlasting joy of the elect. And I picked that one because I think it's really connected to John's prison experience, that great adversities that he experienced and felt, and saying, but you don't know what God is going to do through them. And I'm sure he would be so amazed if he had known in that moment of great suffering the poetry that would flow, the spiritual teaching, the being raised up to a new spiritual level in his life, you know, and helping so many others through this experience. So I think it's a good one to keep in mind, you know, when anyone's suffering great adversities, but especially, I think, connected to John's imprisonment.
Yeah. Well, when we left off, John had already been arrested and imprisoned, or attempted to imprison him once before without success. But maybe we can, to get us back into it, the interlying times between when he was released that first time and then ultimately to his imprisonment that lasted for many months.
We mentioned last week about how they even had some locals were standing guard basically at this house where John was living, because they knew that there was going to be these attempts to come. But still, we don't know the exact date, but it was around December 2nd or 3rd in 1577 that the house friars came in with a bunch of like armed locals, and they took John and his companion and led them to the Calced Monastery to put them in the monastery prison. But I think it's important too that we understand, like, this concept of a monastery prison is so foreign to our experience. And now I think it's important too that we, like, maybe just discuss a little bit about what that was, why was this happening?
Yeah. Well, I think one thing too, we've used the words calced and discalced a lot, but I'm not sure if we've ever explained the meaning of those words. So just to say, you know, the tension between the calced was basically means shoed, right? That it's just a sign. The discalced was the sign of the reform, so they wore sandals or barefoot. Whereas the Carmelites that they came from, the ancient order of Carmelites, wore shoes. And so calced meaning shoes and discalced meaning de-shoed, I guess.
Right.
So that's the tension between the reform and the ancient order of the Carmelites. But in terms of the monastery prison, I think, yeah, it's very good to get context, because it can almost sound like, how could these religious be so, you know, terrible to their people? But it was the penal system of the time, you know, that you had the secular arm and the ecclesial arm in terms of regulating laws and penalties and things. So if a friar acted out in some way, he would be taken care of, in a sense, his punishment by the ecclesial arm. Whereas now that's so foreign to us. But that kind of helps give some sense of why the need for a prison in the monastery.
And it was actually an act of mercy, in a sense of like freeing the person from the from the secular arm of the penal system, which often was very unfair. There's a lot of bribery and things like that. So it was this understanding that within the monastery, they had their own way of punishing people. And we don't know exactly what John was being charged with, but it seems pretty clear, at least, that they saw that John was living in a house outside of one of the monasteries. And they thought that they basically demanded that he return to one of the monasteries. But John was living there under the permission of, directly under the permission of the Pope through the nuncio. And so he felt like he was justified in where he was living. But we understand too that other friars thought that he was being disobedient and rebellious. And so they saw it as really as an act of mercy. It was their role to come to take him and to bring him back to their monastery.
And this gets back to what we were talking about last time with this confusion, right, between the who has the authority. And this is sort of what caused all of this confusion about, you know, in the eyes of the reform, they're following, obeying, you know, in obedience to their lawful superiors. And for the Kaust or the original order, you know, they think that they are acting in accord with obedience and what is right, according to the authority that they think that is being given in this situation. And because there's all these muddled things happening in terms of the national, the government, the Spanish government, in terms of their influence, in terms of what the Pope through his representatives are enacting, as well as through the authority of the actual order, mm-hmm. there's these, you know, coming from all different directions, these interventions that are happening that honestly just probably confuse the whole situation.
Yeah, and there's so much at stake for John too, because you think it would be very easy to say, okay, I'll just go live in the monastery. I don't have to live in this little house. It would solve all the difficulties. But by doing that, he's basically saying that they have the authority and that the Discalcs don't. And so if he were to do that and give in a sense, it could undermine the whole project of the Discalcs. So he had to be very careful of what he would kind of submit to.
I was also struck, though, that he did submit in the sense of he wasn't violent. I mean, he went with them when they came to arrest him. But one thing I really like is when they first brought him to the monastery, I think it was just the very next day, they allowed him. I mean, he's a prisoner, but it's not like he's in chains, locked in a room and, like, you know, treated in that sense. At the beginning, I mean, the monastery prison, he was allowed to join them in prayer and to say Mass. And so his first day after he was captured, after he says Mass, he sees a chance and he escapes and he runs as quickly as he can back to the little house that he was staying in and locks the door and just starts burning or destroying letters or other documents that he had. And we can see he wasn't concerned about trying to get away himself, but he was concerned that the letters that he had would maybe get others in trouble, like Teresa. I'm sure he was worried about Teresa. He probably had letters from her concerning the reform. And so he went and did what he could to destroy those. And then, of course, they were chasing after him, and they caught up with him and then brought him back to the monastery again. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So eventually he's brought back, and this time they're not taking any chances with him. And this sort of begins the longer period of John's imprisonment. And maybe we can talk about just in terms of what he suffered within that imprisonment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, first we see, we can break down, I think, his suffering on many different levels. There was the physical suffering that comes with just, being in prison, but also there was psychological and spiritual suffering. And I don't know, maybe it'd be helpful to talk about all those separately. Can you tell us a little bit of, like, what was his physical experience like in the prison?
Yeah, well, and like you said, there were kind of stages. So eventually he got to this point because they found out his companion in the house had escaped, German. And so then they thought, well, we really need to keep him under guard. So they put him in a much smaller cell, and this is in Toledo now, and in which was essentially a kind of a restroom for visiting, you know, prelates or dignitaries. So it's basically a bathroom, you know, that they put him in.
6 feet by 10 feet.
6 feet by 10, yeah, with just a little sliver of a window, you know, so being deprived of light, of space, you know, and I think for me, at least, what hits me is like not being able to bathe himself or even change his shirt, you know, and so here he is in a habit, and not being able to, yeah, take care of me, ends up getting lice and just the way that torments him. So just like the lack of hygiene. And he was a very meticulous and clean person too, you know. So the lack of hygiene, I think, just caused probably incredible just suffering, just being in that state all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, and then eventually we see because of his bad conditions and also his diet, they gave him very little food as far as bread. I think they said like one or two sardines occasionally. But over a long period of time, that began to eat away at his health, and he became very seriously ill. Yeah. And again, we don't want to see it as like, why, yeah, it's just gonna be shocking. Why were these religious treating him in this way? But especially at the beginning, they thought it was for his good. They kept trying to allow him. They were even offering him, like, just come live in the monastery with us. We'll make you a prior. Like, we'll give you a position of honor if you come and live with us. But they just saw this John as being just very obstinate and unwilling to give in to what they thought was the proper authority.
I think that leads to sort of the psychological aspects of the turmoil, because here they are, you know, tempting him with positions of power, and also the humiliation that was sort of a part of, you know, in terms of encouraging humility, maybe in their eyes, the eyes of the Caliph, but making him meet on his knees in the midst of the refectory while all the other brothers are around him, and then also receiving the discipline in front of the brothers as well would have been very psychologically difficult for him.
Yes, and especially because he knew some of these guys. You know, he had studied with them in Salamanca and other places. He had run-ins with them, so these weren't just like strangers. You know, these were his brothers, and to be experiencing that from their hands.
Yeah, and later on, John would remember. It's recounted that he said his greatest suffering though was worrying about the others in the reform and what they might be going through. So he wasn't, in all this, he wasn't concerned about his own condition. Even though they would stand outside of his room and like apparently some of the friars would speak about how the whole reform had been smashed or how like Teresa had given up on it or all these things, they were really trying to like get into his mind. But his main concern was he didn't want them to be punished or for his sake.
Yeah, I remember reading too that he was preoccupied that how sad Teresa would be, you know, because that there are rumors maybe that he had given in and that he had given up the reform and what that would do to her just emotionally, you know, and that's how much he loved her.
In terms of the spiritual suffering that he encountered, we don't know a lot, but we do know his response to the suffering, which was he wrote lines and lines of poetry.
Yes. Yeah, and at the beginning, he wouldn't have had access to anything to write on. So we can see at the beginning, it seems that he was probably just writing these things in his mind, perhaps, because he wouldn't have had, paper. But that seems to be an outlet for him as far as, like, kind of dealing with the physical and the psychological. But I think perhaps more than that, what the spiritual experience that he was going through throughout this time.
Yeah. Well, you think he... You know, way before this, of course, he always had the same mentality, spirituality of seeking the cross as the source of all blessings. And here he was in a place to just receive it in a very intense way. But because of his response, just the outflowing of the resurrection, you think, in his poetry and some of his own spiritual experiences too, like there's witnesses that say they saw light in his cell, you know, and came in. Apparently once the prior came in and said he's either a sorcerer or a saint, you know, because stuff was happening in a sense through his suffering because he was able so much to just give it to the Lord.
Yeah, and I think it's good for us to realize too, even though, I mean, he had great faith, it wasn't this experience of just like happiness for him. Yeah. It was great darkness, and we can see that in some of his poetry. I've read that the spiritual canticle is probably, which he wrote most of during his imprisonment, is probably the best, like, view into his interior experience during that time. And much of the spiritual canticle is about this idea of searching for God, a hidden God, and not finding him. Mm-hmm. And so that seems to be what John spiritually is experiencing most often. There are also like moments of great spiritual light, I think, but I'd say overall it was an experience of almost feeling abandoned by God.
Yes, and of course he talks about that later in The Dark Night and in the treatise on The Dark Night, of that being one of the hardest parts of going through those experiences is that sense of abandonment. Mm-hmm. And so he definitely went through that. Yeah.
We know that 5 months into the imprisonment, a new jailer, so a new brother was brought in to oversee as his warden, so to speak. And it's from this friar that John receives pen and paper, and he's able to write some of these things down. We've mentioned the spiritual canticle, but what are some of the other things that John wrote during this time of imprisonment?
Well, there's one that in certain translation is called I Remember the Font, and it's essentially a Eucharistic meditation, and it's one of his more beautiful ones and less known, but you can see this longing he has for the hidden God through the Eucharist, because he himself wasn't able to celebrate the Eucharist. And so that what that created, and you think the connection maybe with the pandemic, you know, where you're deprived and it's outside of your control, but how God can use that to increase the hunger and have beautiful creative output, you know, through that. So That's one I think is worth going to just to get a sense of his own devotion to our Lord and the Blessed Sacrament and, yeah, what that deprivation did to him.
Yeah. And then he also wrote the Romances, which are kind of, it's a commentary on the prologue of the Gospel of John. And you can just imagine, I mean, in the liturgy at that time, that prologue to the Gospel of John is recited at every single Mass. And so he would have this memorized, and it would be something that would just constantly be in his mind. And so he wrote this, it's really like kind of these beautiful stanzas on like diving into the spiritual reality of God within himself, but then God's outflowing love into the world in his creation of the world. And I've actually read, we don't know exactly when he wrote all these different things, but it makes sense that perhaps he would have written this during Advent, because it would have been on his mind, this idea of the incarnation. And that's kind of where this poem culminates, is with the incarnation. So he was taking the scripture that he had just so ingrained in him, and through the lens of the spiritual seasons that he was still trying to live, even though he was locked in this tiny cell, and out was flowing these beautiful verses.
Yeah. I think it's a good reminder, too, of just like, you know, it's tempting when you're in that kind of suffering and that situation just to turn in on yourself, and how one of his ways of coping with what he was going through was just to look at God, to look at the beauty of creation in the spiritual canticle, to look at the beauty of redemption in the Romances, and you know, the whole point for our being made by God. So he was gazing at the mysteries of God, I think, was such a help for him to not just turn in on himself and, you know, kind of get closed in on himself.
So in the midst of John's imprisonment towards the end of this period, we know a few things that are going on sort of meanwhile. We know that Teresa is searching for him and trying to figure out where he is. Could you speak a little bit about what's kind of going on with the reform? You know, John's being told lies essentially about the failure of the reform, but we know that things are going on elsewhere.
Yeah, I think that's one of the big questions that you could have, especially not knowing all the details, is like, well, where were his brothers in all this? How could they just let him be there for 9 months? And especially Teresa, because she had a lot of influence with important people at this time. But one thing that I like is that when you really dig into the research, that from the first day that Teresa found out, basically, she is doing all she can. She's writing letters to the king. She's writing letters to those in authority to like try to help get John out of this situation. So it's something that he's not forgotten, especially by Teresa.
Yeah, I like there was a line, she turned over heaven and earth to try to, you know, help John. And she was so worried too, not even about not knowing where he was, but what they might be doing to him, you know? Just again, that sense that she had of that love. And her own incomprehensibility too. Why does no one seem to be caring? Why is no one doing anything? You know, and she's this kind of almost lone voice in the midst of all of it.
Yeah. And then at the same time, some of the tensions are eased in the sense of there's a brief that the king had put out that he later withdraws. But it doesn't seem like necessarily the Carmelites that were holding John in prison understood all the intricacies of this. So even though John should have been released by this brief, because Teresa wrote to the king and asked this of him, the Carmelites don't necessarily understand everything, and so John's still kept in prison.
We know that at some point he begins to make preparations to escape, and by the time August comes, he finds his opportunity. So maybe we could talk about his escape and what came of it.
Yeah. Well, one thing is that he finally got a more sympathetic jailer, you know, in those last 2 months, and who helped him, you know, giving him pen and paper to write down some of these poems that he had composed in his own head, and then gave him a change of clothes finally. So he knew he had kind of an in now, but he was still, you know, his sickness, he had dysentery, and, you know, he wasn't eating enough. He was very sick in his stomach, and he knew if this keeps going, he would die. He's so skinny already, such a small man. But I think what finally broke, you know, kind of that decision to say, I have to get out or I will die, was the experience of asking for Mass.
Yeah, on the eve of the Assumption, he asked the prior if he could say Mass in honor of Our Lady for the Assumption, and the prior told him, no, basically laughed in his face and said no. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of like the turning point. Something, I mean, we don't know necessarily what role Our Lady played in this decision, but she was definitely there. And it was because John was being, he was very docile through all of this. They actually called him the muffled file, those who were holding him, because he was just so passive and loving through it all. But once he realized, like, it was either escape or die, and that was kind of what it turned his decision. And like you said, the new jailer, he provided him with like a needle and thread to mend his habit, and John could use that thread to measure out the window a distance, mm-hmm. how far it was down to the ground below. And also the jailer provided him a little more freedom in the sense of after lunch, when all the friars were taking a siesta, he let John go out and just walk around a little bit. And this provided John with the opportunity to kind of scope things out and to like make a plan.
Yeah, and you think that jailer too, after the fact, he was not upset that John escaped. And he had to be deprived. He said he got in trouble in a sense, but he was very happy with that because he recognized John's holiness. And as did some of the other friars there too. He said some of the younger ones especially would weep sometimes when they would see how he was being treated because they saw this as a holy man and knew, you know, this, yeah, we shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah.
So John makes the preparations. How does he do it?
Yeah, well, this is part of the kind of quasi-miraculous nature of it, because here he is already so weak. And so he takes, you know, his little blanket, probably not much of a blanket that they gave him, and tore strips out of it so that he, you know, would have something to get him out of the window. And I think of the movie, the Shawshank Redemption, because in that movie Andy Dufresne waits for the thunderstorm to start banging. And John did similar. Apparently, I guess certain friars maybe were snoring during at night, and he would wait at a certain point when there were some noises being made that he would bang out his lock, because he had already loosened the screws and got out his padlock so that people wouldn't hear it.
The provincial had arrived and was sleeping at the room just outside of where he was staying. So it was just crazy to think he chose this time to like hit the lock to fall off, and then it fell off onto the ground and they woke up, but then John just remained silent until they fell back asleep. And then you can just, it is like, it's like an action movie.
But then taking those strips too, and eventually getting a little like thing tied up so that he could hang off, they say like it should never have been able to support him, and it was way too short, you know? So like it really shouldn't have worked in a way, but somehow he got down.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's amazing just from his weak physical strength, like at this time, that he could even lower himself down these blankets.
Yeah.
And then he gets to the end, and you know, a fall from this height would kill him. He gets down to the end of the blankets, and he still has like, I think, another 10 feet to the ground from the bottom of the blanket. And so he has to drop down again. And it's just, it's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So once John's to the ground, he's in a foreign place. He doesn't really, I'm sure he knew he was in Toledo, but was he familiar much with where the nuns were? And I'm sure he didn't have much familiarity of where he needed to go. And another sort of a miraculous situation for him to find help once he was free and loose.
Yeah, well, they'd blindfolded him, you know, so he had no idea where he was, like when they took him there. And then when he dropped down, he didn't realize that, they were like catty-cornered to a Conceptionist monastery of nuns. And so he dropped into their cloister, you know, and that are surrounded by walls. And so he almost was despaired, because you think you did all this, and then what else are you going to do? So I'd read that, you know, he could have called for help, because what else do you do at this point? But somehow, I don't know, miraculously, he just found this little corner, and he just sort of boosted himself up on this very high wall that he shouldn't have been able to get on, and was able to climb over.
Yeah, and then he went out into the streets of Toledo.
Yeah,
and ultimately he finds his way to the Discalced Nuns in Toledo.
Right.
They help him, and of course, the Calced are looking for him, and through the sheer genius of the prioress in Toledo, he's able to remain hidden from his pursuers.
Yeah. Yeah, what was the line?
It would be a miracle if you were to find a friar here.
so she wasn't lying necessarily to the friar, but
when the friars came looking for him, that was the prioress or the sister, the nun portress. That's what was her response.
Yeah.
Great. So we know through the midst of all of this that we, there's some relationship with the famous poem of St. John of the Cross, The Dark Knight. And when you read The Dark Knight, you kind of get a sense of maybe he's inspired by this his being sprung from prison to write this poem. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think with The Dark Knight and being written after, but in similar with the Spiritual Canticle being written during, it's just amazing how he was able to contextualize his whole experience in this love affair with God, you know, this going after his beloved and his beloved going after him. And so I think both of those, they show the suffering he went through, the drama of imprisonment, but always through the lens of love and beauty and goodness that God wants to pour out on him. So yeah, I think it says so much, and it just gives a sense of where he was spiritually with all this.
So maybe just to finish, we'll read just this, the poem of The Dark Knight, and just to reflect on that experience and how it related to John's experience with God. One dark night, fired with love's urgent longings, ah, the sheer grace, I went out unseen, my house being now all stilled, in darkness and secure, by the secret ladder disguised, ah, the sheer grace, in darkness and concealment, my house being now all stilled. On that glad night in secret, for no one saw me, nor did I look at anything with no other light or guide than the one light that burned in my heart. This guided me more surely than the light of noon to where he was awaiting me, him I knew so well. There in a place where no one appeared, O guiding light, O night more lovely than the dawn, O night that has united the lover with his beloved, transforming the beloved in her lover. Upon my flowering breast, which I kept holy for him alone, there he lay sleeping, and I caressing him there in a breeze from the fanning cedars. When the breeze blew from the turret, I parted his hair. I wounded my neck with its gentle hand. Suspending all my senses, I abandoned and forgot myself, laying my face on my beloved. All things ceased. I went out from myself, leaving my cares forgotten among the lilies.
Hey everyone, Brother Pier Giorgio here. Thanks for checking out this episode of Carmelcast. If you want to hear more of us, don't forget to click subscribe. Also, be sure to click like if you enjoyed this episode, and maybe even leave us a comment. We post discussion questions down below to get the conversation going. Want more information on Carmelite spirituality and the Discalced Carmelite Saints? Then you'll want to check out our website, www.icspublications.org. There's a link in the description of this episode. From here, you can see all our current promotions and access our complete catalog for the writings of St. John of the Cross, St. Teresa of Avila, St. Therese of Lisieux, St. Elizabeth of the Trinity, and St. Edith Stein. If you want to stay up to date on all our promotions and new titles, then be sure to add your email to our email list. There's no better way to stay up to date on the latest Carmelite publications. Thanks for joining us, and may God bless you.